This is The Guardian.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe, das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Wie kann man Risiko im Leben reduzieren? Einen Helm tragen, fit bleiben und die Freunde meiden, die verrückte Ideen hatten. Und beim Investieren? Hier sollte man diversifizieren. Wenn du in einen iShares ETF investierst, kaufst du in einem Schritt einen Teil von Hunderten oder Tausenden von Unternehmen. So musst du dir keine Sorgen mehr machen. Du kannst dir stattdessen lieber Gedanken darüber machen, wer die Fotos von der wilden Nacht mit deinen Freunden gemacht hat. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
Family dynasty that controlled Syria for more than half a century is no longer in power.
Assad regime has fallen, and I welcome that news. But what we need to see is a political resolution in line with the UN resolution.
Too many people in Whitehall are comfortable in the tepid bath of managed decline.
It's right that we expect people to focus on delivery. So I'm not here today to talk about what lanyards people are wearing or to open up another chapter in the culture war.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
Even though we're sitting here again in our broom cupboard in Westminster, Kieran, the news over the weekend has very firmly been on Syria and the events that have been unfolding in the Middle East, where we saw the regime of Bashar al-Assad fall with the ousted leader and his family then fleeing to Moscow. It was a very dramatic and quick offensive. It took the rebels just 2 weeks to make it to Damascus and seize control of the capital, finally bringing an end to Assad's 24-year-long rule. And the celebrations on the ground in Damascus, in Homs, in other cities across Syria, have been raucous. There's a lot of hope in the air on the ground, but is it really justified?
Yeah, I think it kind of caught people in London by surprise. First of all, the speed of it, but second of all, you know, just a month ago, this was not on the radar. Nobody I was talking to in the Foreign Office was mentioning this as one of their hotspots to watch over the winter break. It has obviously happened very quickly, probably with Moscow and Tehran focusing on other parts of the world. This was the time when the rebels felt that they could actually take advantage of that situation. One of the images that I think came to mind, and it wasn't just me for whom this is the case, but is that image of Saddam Hussein's statue being toppled at the relative beginning of the Iraq war, and the celebrations that accompanied that, and the sense of hope and possible renewal for that country, which then, you know, fell apart very rapidly after that. And that is also the analogy which Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, has been talking about as well. I mean, what he was saying, remember what it felt like when Saddam's statue was toppled and remember what happened next. And he's not the only one. Jonathan Hall, the government's anti-terror chief, has been talking about, well, saying that he's as worried as I was with Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. Yeah. So, you know, there is clearly hope on the ground and among returning Syrians. Incredible footage, by the way, today of roads chock-a-block full of cars coming back from the border with Turkey back into Syria. But I think that the feeling certainly here in London, and I assume in Washington as well, is more one of trepidation.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. We have been here before. And I was thinking this morning about Libya and how that was characterized as a humanitarian intervention. Mm. But now Libya is effectively a failed state, hugely politically unstable, huge economic problems, not a dependable regional partner. And while Bashar al-Assad has ruled, and his father before him, have ruled Syria with an iron fist, you know, huge brutality, about a quarter of the population fled, displaced, and 500,000 people killed during that conflict. He was a predictable figure in the Middle East, or a more predictable figure, even though he was regarded as a rogue figure by Western nations. And they will be keeping a very close eye on what happens next, because I think the message they're very keen to get across to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, the rebel group that has taken over, is that stability is really, really important. They need to respect the rule of law, particularly when it comes to minority groups, the concern, of course, being what happens to women in particular, that the political processes have to stay in place. And also whether they take revenge on their very many enemies, the regime, many of whom are still in Syria, you know, what happens to them now? And I think, again, the rule of law is really important there, despite the presumably overwhelming temptation for some of those, you know, weapons touting rebels that have stormed Damascus and the other former regime strongholds. So it's definitely one which the West, including Britain, are going to be looking at very closely. And perhaps as a first step, they're looking at how we regard HTS, which of course is an Islamist group and was a former Al-Qaeda associate. And even though their leader had kind of split away from Al-Qaeda and attempted to take a more sort of pragmatic political approach, he does still have those links. And HTS is currently still a proscribed terrorist group in the UK, in the US and across the West. And Keir Starmer suggested over the weekend that it was very early days, but that they may well end up, the UK government may well end up looking again at whether the group would remain on the proscribed list. But Keir Starmer is right at the heart of the action today, isn't he? Because he's in the Gulf. What's he up to there?
Well, it's another Monday where we're here in Westminster and Keir Starmer is elsewhere.
Had a few of those.
Yep. This time he's in the UAE this morning. Some amazing photos we were looking at this morning.
Stunning.
Coming out of Abu Dhabi of him touring a temple. Really, really beautiful shots. And then he travels to Saudi Arabia in the afternoon. Actually, the timing on this, as you say, turns out to have been very good in a sense, because he will be right there in the heart of the action talking to leaders who actually have a say.
And it was supposed to be a trade mission, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was
this is supposed to be drumming about the investment.
The drum for Britain.
And remember as well that he comes on the back of just having made some fairly major concessions on the football governance bill, which said that he basically made the decision that they would drop this clause that you should take into account foreign policy considerations when deciding whether prospective owners of Premier League clubs are fit and proper people to own those clubs. And that was seen as a sop to Saudi Arabia, who, of course, have an interest in Newcastle United. Yeah. So the idea was, look, we've moved on this one piece of policy that maybe some people in the Middle East weren't very keen on. And now I'm here to drum up some investment for the UK and talk of, you know, clean energy investments being top of that list. I assume a lot of those meetings are going to get changed now and it will be much more security focused. I think, however, having said that Britain probably doesn't want to get too involved in this conflict at all. I mean, it's not going to look good if there is any sense that the UK is backing any particular side in this or has skin in the game. This is a conflict that we have largely remained clear of in the last few years.
Certainly since that vote in 2013 when David Cameron wanted to have the option of responding to Syria when Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons against his own people. And the vote didn't make it through Parliament, largely, it has to be said, because Ed Miliband, then leader of the Labour Party, corralled his troops, I think probably haunted by what has happened over Iraq and the intervention there, to vote against.
Yeah. Sometimes people ask me, what does a leader of the opposition, you know, what can a leader of the opposition really achieve or change? And I always think back to that vote. I mean, not only did Ed Miliband probably change British foreign policy at that moment, he also changed American foreign policy.
Yeah, because Barack Obama felt he didn't have the backing, the support of Britain, and they would be on their own in this regard.
Yeah, so Obama pretty much overnight dropped the idea that this was a red line, that somehow if crossed, the US would have to intervene militarily. Now, people like Michael Gove, I should say, who was always very, very pro-intervention in Syria, would probably say, look, this is where you end up if you don't take those decisions. Mm-hmm. If you don't confront these conflicts head on, you end up in the mess that we've had for the last 10, 11 years in Syria, and now a chaotic end to that mess. However, people on the other side of the argument will point to Libya and say, yeah, well, we intervened there and it didn't go much better. So I think for that reason, the feeling is in London, this is a regional conflict, albeit drawing in Russia as well. And it's one that we really don't particularly want to get dragged into.
But one area, of course, where the UK does have an interest is the number of British citizens in the Kurdish run north of the country. And they're people who left the UK to join ISIS, including, of course, Shamima Begum, who, as you'll remember, left the UK as a 15-year-old and married an Islamic State militant. And since then has been attempting to return to the UK, but has had her British citizen stripped from her, a case which culminated in the Supreme Court earlier this year, which concluded that she had no right to have that citizenship reinstated. But the government estimated, I think it was about 900 Brits had gone to Syria and Iraq, had joined Islamic State, fought with them. An estimated 540 had returned, and somewhere between 180 and 320 individuals remain in Syria. So from a UK perspective, the last government was obviously very against bringing back those individuals to the UK, although some did return and faced the law here. It'd be interesting to see whether this government takes the same approach and where the balance lies on the human rights issues as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think for now they'll just be really praying that the Kurdish forces remain in charge of that camp and that it doesn't just become a free-for-all where people are able to disappear over the border without Western officials being able to track where they actually are.
Before we move on from this trip, we should just mention that Keir Starmer has not taken a press pass. No Guardian journalist out there with him on his trip to the Gulf, which includes a meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi leader. And no British Prime Minister has taken a press pack with them since the regime's murder of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Now, is that a coincidence or is that a demand of the Saudis, not known for their love of free press, but nevertheless one that Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, and now it looks like Keir Starmer is set to follow? And I know that we at The Guardian have protested that decision and would continue to argue that we should be there to hold our Prime Minister, regardless of what party they're from, to account when they're there representing the British people.
Yeah, you're right. That's a really good point, because usually the trips where the Prime Minister doesn't take a travelling press pack with them are fairly bland. Often it's the kind of Christmas trip to see some troops somewhere where there's not really news being created, but you just want to see the images. So a photographer and a camera person will go along with them. This is very different. This is a foreign policy trip and it, you know, could have a significant bearing on politics in this country too.
Now, something interesting has happened in the last few weeks, which we've both picked up on. Despite Labour promising to reset relations with Whitehall when they came in, and sort of initial sort of collective sigh of relief almost from the civil service that they were no longer going to sort of get the hammering they did under some Conservatives, there are signs that the old battles between ministers and civil servants are starting to re-emerge. Now, there was that speech last week with the Prime Minister, his big reset, not a reset speech, his plan for change, which raised heckles among some in Whitehall when he said, too many people in Whitehall are comfortable in the tepid bath of managed decline. Now, listening to that speech, I was kind of like, oh my goodness, this is not what we've come to expect from Keir Starmer himself, of course, formerly a senior civil servant when he ran the Crown Prosecution Service. And now this morning, Pat McFadden, Cabinet Office Minister, has been talking about making the British state more like a startup. I mean, that was slightly alarming to me, given most startups end up failing.
Going bust, yeah.
What's going on? Why has the government come over all Dominic Cummings?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's something I've picked up as well from talking to ministers who've just taken up posts, essentially. And one of the questions I ask pretty much every minister when I talk to them is, has anything surprised you about going into this job? And one thing that has come up a couple of times is actually I've been really surprised by not just the amount of bureaucracy. Some people say, hey, look, I'm tied down by bureaucracy and getting a decision cleared is just an absolute nightmare. Now, that's just the system, really, isn't it? And yes, you can try and change that system, but that is what it is like being in government. But there are also people who've said to me, I found parts of the civil service actively resistant to what we're trying to do, which has really surprised me. And it particularly, I think, has come from departments where they are trying to overturn things that the previous government has done. And one minister said to me, you know, the thing is, as long as you're building on what the previous government has done, you're absolutely fine. Civil servants are very happy to go along with that. But if you're trying to do something that goes against what, you know, Whitehall has thought for a long time is a good idea. The way they described it is there are pockets of or groups of people in Westminster who are now so used to being in opposition to the government, having gone through the last few years, that they just see themselves as, see their jobs as being to block what the government wants. And these are exactly the kinds of complaints that the Tories used to make in power, and Labour people used to dismiss them. But, you know, it seems that there is, at least in certain parts of Whitehall, a problem there. And ministers in this government, as well as the last one, feel they need to clear it.
So that's really interesting, because I've spoken to lots of ministers as well about how they've worked with the civil service. And I think most of them acknowledge that things are harder to get through than they'd anticipated. But there's not a sort of overwhelming sense that there is a sort of a collective mindset in the civil service that is trying to stymie them. I mean, there may well be individuals that you've mentioned. More that the system itself isn't fit for purpose. Now, you say that's just part of government, that's the way it is. And actually, you know, a radical transformation of the way the civil service works is a much more complicated outcome to achieve, even probably than some policy implementation, because it has to be, you know, root and branch, and it's changing a culture which has existed for a very long time. But where they do agree with the people you've been talking to is that we've had such a tumultuous few years here in Britain on the domestic policy front because of the changes in government, because of the sort of, you know, the political nature of what of a lot of how the country's been run, that civil servants who perhaps are innately cautious anyway are even more so and need greater persuasion to sort of, you know, implement sometimes quite radical changes, precisely because they feel kind of like they've been here before. And it takes a while to kind of change that mindset, doesn't it? But Pat McFadden's trying to do so this morning when he's touting this plan, forgetting, I feel like we've been here before, but forgetting those in tech startups to come and join the civil service, which, as we say, is sort of, you know, almost like Dominic Cummings style language. Now, he had two announcements. One was that there'd be individuals and companies invited into the civil service for a sort of 6 to 12 months to focus on specific policy problems, and that the Cabinet Office had put aside 100 million quid to recruit private sector workers so that they could behave more like a startup. Again, big caveat on that, warning signals. Do we really want government to be a startup? And they got this, what they're calling a test and learn culture, which kind of makes sense, doesn't it? That you pilot things, see if they work. If they do, you proceed with them and roll them out more widely. If they don't, then, you know, you put it down to experience and don't proceed down that route. And then the other thing is these quasi-independent crack teams, which are deployed to two particular policy areas, family support and temporary accommodation. And they're going to be looking in Manchester, Sheffield, Essex, Liverpool at what works and crucially what doesn't, and working out, you know, how to proceed with that. The man in charge of all of this is going to be Chris Wilmot, the new cabinet secretary. It is Simon Case's last week in post this week. And then Chris Wilmald, the former permanent secretary at the Department for Health and Social Care, takes over. And while there have been plenty of his colleagues who have suggested that he would be willing to head up some of that radical reform, there are others who point to the fact that he is a career-long civil servant who oversaw DHSC during the pandemic and might not be the best person to be, you know, flight of foot and innovative in the way that Pat McFadden seems to want.
I remember about 10 years ago, the coalition government talking about bringing in business people as permanent secretaries as one way to drive change in the civil service. And you know, that just doesn't really seem to have happened. I mean, it's fine to have all this rhetoric about making the civil service more like a business and more like a startup. But, and I'm thinking this more and more with this government, you've got to watch what they do and not what they say. Mm. And on all sorts of areas, Keir Starmer in particular will say very grand things and then do things which kind of run counter to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also important for them politically, because of course they've got reform snapping at their heels. There's a poll from Find Out Now which put reform above Labour on 24%, only just behind the Tories, which was out just this weekend. I mean, that looks like it's positioning Reform as the unofficial opposition party. And I remember a conversation I had with Morgan McSweeney, who was running Labour's election campaign and now, of course, is Keir Starmer's chief of staff, before the general election, in which he said, look, you need to recognise that the political landscape could change quite dramatically even from where we are now. And that the next election is not necessarily going to be yet another rerun of Tories versus Labour, as we've got used to in this country, that there could be a dramatic political realignment with the rise of Reform. reform. And actually, the fight would be potentially between Labour and reform for power. And I kind of remember thinking, oh my God, you've not even won this election yet. You know, why are you thinking so far ahead? But he is right. And Downing Street and people in Downing Street and Morgan McSweeney have said the same thing repeatedly since. The insurgents that do well politically globally at the moment and the incumbents that don't. And Labour have very quickly come into power, having promised change, looking like, you know, they're the incumbents, they're the same, there's no change, that's the charge against them. Of course, they would challenge that and set out all the different policies that they have brought in that are different. But the challenge that they're going to have is that regardless of what they do, reform are going to look like the insurgents, and reform are managing to sound as though, you know, they're anti-establishment, they're on the side of the people. You know, that's why their membership is 100,000 and growing. That's why they're doing well in the polls.
Yeah, I think, I mean, first of all, on Morgan McSweeney's first point that the next election could feel very different from this one that's just gone. Do you know that this week it is 5 years exactly since the 2019 election?
Oh, really?
On Thursday, it's the 50 year anniversary of Boris Johnson, his 80 seat majority.
Wow.
And what we were expecting of several terms of Johnson government.
Oh,
so yeah, I think McSweeney's right on that one. The other thing I would say is this next 4 years is going to be a real test of one particular thing, and that's whether delivery still works for governments. So there's been a lot of talk about this. There's been essays written about whether this works or not. And essentially, there's one theory that says, look at what's happened in the US. Joe Biden oversaw a fantastic economic success story, particularly in the last couple of years. He sorted out a lot of the problems had dogged the US economy for a long time. He attracted investments. He got growth going way beyond what any other country had got. And yet Democrats still got a hammering at the presidential election. Therefore, what we're seeing is that voters no longer care about whether governments deliver or not. They'd rather have a howl of pain from somebody who comes from outside the system than they would a government quietly getting on with the job and putting things right. Morgan McSweeney would absolutely deny that. And remember where he comes from. His politics were formed in those battles of East London, where he and others, Margaret Hodge in particular, managed to keep out the BNP, partly, in McSweeney's telling, by figuring out that the pockets of hot support for the BNP also correlated to where there were lots of potholes in the roads.
And by going in front gardens.
Flying to be
like
in front
that.
Gardens. Yeah. And by going around and fixing the potholes and cleaning up the streets, they were able to deal with that threat from the far right. And this essentially is a nationwide gamble on that theory being able to pay off again, bringing waiting lists down a bit and making people feel a bit more secure in their jobs, getting the trains running more smoothly. Can those kinds of changes keep out the far right, or are we now just in a different era of politics?
And people I've been talking to in Downing Street say that they understand that obviously delivery is at the heart of everything they have to do, but it also has to be more than that. It has to be about how they, as they put it, tell the story. And that's what Starmer's speech last week was supposed to be about, and I think probably actually has failed to kind of start, they've been in power for 5 months, but to continue sort of shaping the narrative about what Labour would do differently. And it's, I know it's very frustrating to some of those people, some senior Labour figures and some of those inside Downing Street, that sort of story isn't landing in quite the way that they'd hoped. And they're trying to think of all sorts of innovative ways that they could do it, you know, social media influencers, you know, thinking outside the box as to how they get their message out there. You know, they do, as we say pretty much every week here, and they do have time on their side, but they're also conscious that Reform came second in 98 seats at the election, and 89 of those were in Labour seats, many in the north of England and a big chunk in Wales as well. And, you know, we've got the Senate elections in 2026. We've seen Reform, who launched their manifesto for the general election in South Wales, really trying to sort of make inroads there as a way of, I guess, showing in a smaller sphere that they can, you know, that they can win, if not power, certainly sort of positions of influence on the Senate, but also road testing their theories, their policies, their political approaches, whether it, you know, if it works in Wales, in the South Wales Valleys, can it work in the north of England as well? And I was chatting to a senior Reform figure last week at an event I was at, and he was talking about the need to professionalise the party. Now, they're trying to have a sort of constituency office in every constituency. They've kicked out a whole load of people that have made inappropriate or racist remarks over the course of the election and in the aftermath. They're trying to sort of get their membership base really sort of, you know, plugged into communities and delivering on the doorstep. And to me, that mirrors what the Republicans, one aspect of the Republican, what the Republicans did so well in the US elections, which was the ground war. They were embedded in communities, whether it was through church groups, whether it was through community groups. You know, they produced local newspapers that they shoved through people's doors. They sort of held public meetings, you know, for years and years and years before Donald Trump was re-elected. And that's the sort of strategy that Reform have in mind.
The professionalisation thing is really interesting because I reported firsthand on the quote-unquote professionalisation of UKIP during those coalition years. And of course, UKIP during that time won a European election. So there was this real feeling of, oh my goodness.
Which created pressure on David Cameron to have the Brexit
vote.
And
had all sorts of, yeah, exactly. Had massive political consequences. What it didn't do is propel UKIP into government. Mm. And part of the reason for that is any party with Nigel Farage in tends to, at some point, fall into infighting and squabbling. And yes, it's, you know, very impressive that people in Reform are saying we need to professionalise, we need to get down at the grassroots and deliver at community level. But at the same time, their party leader seems to be more and more interested in what's happening over in the States and geopolitics. He's also not the same Nigel Farage there was 10 years ago when he was quite nimble at not always being on the right of any particular argument. He was quite fleet-footed and he would sometimes outflank Labour on the left and he'd say unusual things on immigration every so often that you'd think, oh my goodness, okay, he's not just the tub-thumping right-winger that we all kind of imagine him to be. I find him at the moment much less so. He's got this darker world view, I think, that's more in line with Trumpism. And I just wonder if there's a real weakness in at the heart of Reform. It's actually starting to become Farage himself. Mm-hmm. By going down this American-style rabbit hole, I just wonder whether there's a risk that he will end up alienating some parts of the British electorate.
Yeah, and let's not forget how unpopular Donald Trump is right across the British electorate.
Right. But yeah, so back to what you were saying about the Conservatives, there have, of course, been some fairly high-profile defections recently. Andrea Jenkins, huge supporter of Boris Johnson, now standing for Reform as a mayoral candidate. Last night we had Suella Braverman's husband, Rael, saying that he would defect to Reform, although for the moment, Suella Braverman says she will not do. Mm-hmm. I know lots of Conservatives who are expecting her to do so at one point or another, but she's insisting that won't happen. Tim Montgomery, the founder of Conservative Home, has also defected. A few more of those, and it does start to feel like the you know, one party is essentially hemorrhaging talent to the other.
They're very, very jittery. And I was at the Spectator Parliamentarian of the Year Awards last week, which is a big gathering generally of the, you know, the great and good of the Tory party. That this year they obviously had to lob in a few Labour figures as well. And Nigel Farage actually won, he was on the next table to me, he won an award for Newcomer of the Year.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been around forever, but obviously reference to him being a newcomer in Parliament. And he gave this very striking speech on stage when he warned of a political revolution, the likes of which we've not seen since Labour after World War One. And honestly, the sort of pressure, the atmosphere in the room and the looks on some of the senior Tories' faces was pretty dark. The Reform balloon, however, was delightfully pricked by Michael Gove, now the editor of The Spectator, who took to the podium straight after Nigel Farage had delivered his doom-laden message to the Conservative Party and quipped, "What a confident young man!" Which, of course, the whole room then erupted into laughter. And it kind of like, you know, Farage left the stage actually deflated when he was trying to be very strident.
I was having drinks with some Labour people on Friday night and I've never seen a group of Labour people so enamoured with Michael Gove before. They were delighted by that moment. But it also goes back to exactly what we were just talking about. Nigel Farage, I think in the past, would have given quite a funny, upbeat, mischievous speech at an awards do like that. And yet he's just become subsumed by this much darker political vision. And it'd be really interesting to see how people respond to that in the next few years. Anyway, finally, before we go, this year for the Guardian and Observer's annual charity appeal, we're asking for your support to help individuals whose lives have been turned upside down as a result of conflict. We're partnering with War Child and MSF to help support individuals impacted by the horrific effects of war, from emergency aid to psychological support. Plus, we've also teamed up with Parallel Histories, who help schools teach children about contested conflicts. So if you can, please donate now at theguardian.com/donate24.
Yes, please do donate. They're great causes and every little bit helps. But that's all from us this week. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. And for Politics Weekly UK's end of year special, we'll be taking some of your questions with our Santa hats on, obviously. Whether it was about 2024 or what might come round the corner in 2025, get in touch with me or Kieran or John on any of our social media pages. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Jetzt ist Herbst und bald stehen schon wieder die Feiertage vor der Tür. Das kann auch für Hunde ganz schön stressig sein. Viele Vierbeiner reagieren unter anderem mit einer gestörten Verdauung. Und das ist wiederum Stress für ihre Besitzer. Aber es gibt schnelle und einfache Hilfe. Das Probiotikum Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Streu einfach einen Beutel über das tägliche Futter. Die außergewöhnliche Zusammensetzung mit lebenden guten Darmbakterien stellt das Gleichgewicht im Darm wieder her. Natürlich kannst du ProPlan Fortiflora auch präventiv oder bei alltäglichen Verdauungsbeschwerden einsetzen. Es unterstützt auch bei Ernährungsumstellungen oder Antibiotikaeinnahme. Purina ProPlan Fortiflora. Jetzt auf shop.purina.de.
Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.